What did you rate this one, Sean? Because I didn't.
I gave it a 3.
3? What are you, crazy?
Oh. Obviously.
Do you have your spreadsheet in front of you?
Yes, I do. What do you?
For whatever reason, I didn't have mine in front of me when we rated Second Sight and Sanctuary.
Okay, Second Sight. Andy gave Second Sight a 1.5. You gave it a 1.5. I give it a 2.
Well, you're consistently higher than us. Okay.
Well, no, because Sanctuary. Andy gave it a 2.5. You gave it a 4, and I gave it a 3.
4? What was I, crazy?
Obviously.
That was when I was desperately searching for an episode to like.
Well, it all sort of went downhill because Rivals was the next one.
0.5 for Andy. That is your lowest ranked episode to date.
That's the lowest ranked episode, period.
I wonder if that's going to remain the lowest ranked episode, or if there's going to be one that's worse.
I don't know. Is there? Do we think there's an episode that's a 0 out there? From what I remember, Move Along Home is the one that always stands out for me as being just unbearably unwatchable.
Move Along Home is generally. And I rated that the highest. Yeah, Move Along Home is generally regarded to be Deep Space Nine's near dear. So, with a bit of luck, there isn't going to be one that plummets to those depths again. Hopefully not, anyway.
No, I think overall we're probably going to see more positive ones than negative.
Yeah, I think we're in its weakest season here.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be honest with you. I think season 2 is easily the weakest of the 7.
Yeah, once they get the Dominion and the Jem'Hadar going on and get, you know, once they moved, you know, once Sisko gets the Hawk cut and gets the goatee and everything, you know, I think it's going to start amping up quite a bit. And then Worf moves on to the show and, you know, we get the expansion of the Cardassians, the expansion of the character of Garrick, and then it just sails from there.
It's going to be just 5s every week.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Nerys.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
You're the best crew any captain ever had. This may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. And for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander. The journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
You've lost all contact with the space station.
What the hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the prophets. A Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation. Sean Engel and Andrew Layla.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
All right, do we want to go ahead and do this next one?
Yeah. Let's jump right into it because we're running long.
That's what she said.
No, she did. Sadly, she didn't.
Sorry. Once again, you just lobbed it over the plate and I smacked it out of there. Sorry.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Listen to Them Dare Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast in which I, Paul Spataro, take a unique look at the wonderful Star Trek Deep Space Nine series along with my two sidemen, Andy Leyland.
I am honored to be your sideman. I am honored to be your wingman. I am happy to be your straight man.
And Sean Engel.
I'm going to say that I'm going to be a straight man, hopefully, for a considerable amount of time.
So you're not going to be going through any changes?
No.
We're not going to be having Caitlin Engel?
No, thankfully, no.
I have to call him Shauna.
I identify as male. You know, it's much to the chagrin of some, you know, those jackasses in high school. You can go suck it, you. Never mind.
Lot of pent-up anger though, Sean.
Yeah, well, high school was no fun for anyone who was a geeky non-athletic nerd.
See,
like me.
You
high
said
school
that,
was no fun for anyone. Is that what you just said?
Well, I said no fun for anyone who is a geeky, unathletic nerd like me.
Speaking as a fellow geeky, non-athletic nerd, I loved high school.
But you like sports.
I do like sports, but I really became a sports fan in high school, actually. I wasn't much of one before that.
I don't remember high school.
Too drunk?
Hopefully. that's a good excuse. I genuinely don't. I will see people, and they'll acknowledge me, and I'll be like, I'm sure I was at high school with them, but I vaguely remember that I went to high school. And people don't believe this when I say it to them, but it is 100% true. I don't remember high school. I remember going. I remember enduring the 3 or 5 years or however long it was in high school. But I don't actually remember any. If somebody asked me to write an autobiography about my high school days, it would consist of, I went to high school, I left high school, the end.
And my diploma says this was the school it was.
Yeah.
Are we sure we have Andy Leyland on the call and not Chris Honeywell? I'm certain this is how Chris would describe his high school career. I remember doing it.
He seems to have a very good memory of his high school life.
Which is surprising, knowing what Chris has probably did throughout
Chris's
his
memory
high
of his high school is, yeah, remember this guy? I hated him. Remember this guy? I hated him. How about that guy? I hated him. This guy? Oh, yeah, he was an ass.
Anyway,
we're here today to review the episode Whispers. Season 2, Episode 14. But before we get to that, do either of you gentlemen have any Star Trek discussion to conduct? Insert cricket sound here.
No, it's all quiet on the Trekkian front, isn't it?
I'm going to basically take us back to Eternal Con one last time. And two of the featured guests at Eternal Con were supposed to be Nichelle Nichols and Marina Sirtis. And sadly, Nichelle Nichols, 2 weeks before the show, suffered what is described as mild stroke at her home. And I can only assume that's why she was not at the show. And I wish her well and hope that she recovers well. I'm a little perturbed at the runners of the con because they never took her off as a featured guest and left her listed throughout. In addition, Joe Staten canceled, and they never took him off the guest list. And from a last point of view on that, John Romita Jr. was listed as their featured guest for the show, and he was only there on Sunday, but they never bothered to mention that. So I found that a little bothersome, that they, you know, a little less truth in advertising than I would have liked.
How long has Eternal Con been running? Is it?
This is its third year.
Maybe it's just, you know, that they're that sort of beginning couple of year shakeout period where they don't have things down the way a major con would. Do you think that might be the case?
Well, they clearly want to be seen as a major con, and if that's the case, they need to get a little better organized, and they probably need to find a bigger space to hold it in. It was a little too small of an area for what they, you know, for the amount of people that they had. They weren't very well organized at getting us in. We stood on line, on the ticket holder's line, probably for close to an hour to get into the show. And if you already bought your ticket in advance, there's no excuse for not getting you in quickly. So, you know, those were the negatives of the show. You know, everything else, quite frankly, I found as a positive, but those were the negatives. And you'll hear the positives on the other shows airing on the Two True Freaks Network, where there's going to be, you know, audio footage of what we were doing and discussions of what we were doing and all of that. You know, a lot of the good time was made based on who we were with more so than the show itself. But the show isn't bad. It just needs some tweaking.
Well, you know, three years in, you know, you can kind of forgive them for not having all their ducks in a row. You know, hopefully it's a learning curve, and you know, give it another 3 to 5 years, and it should be running pretty smoothly, I would hope.
Well, I thought the first 2 years it ran more smoothly, and I think that was more a byproduct of the fact that they didn't hold themselves out to be as big of a con. I don't think they sold as many tickets. They charged a little less for the tickets, and I think they viewed themselves as a mid-level show. Now, they really are still a mid-level show, but I think they view themselves as a major con. And that's where I think, you know, they need to do some work. If they want to be a major con, they're going to have to tweak how they handle things. Significantly as far as the guests go, too. Because I think when a guest cancels or when a guest is only going to be there for one day, you really need to make it clear. Because when you're selling tickets for multiple days and a guest who you're listing as your featured guest for the show is only going to be there one of them, it's really not fair to your clientele when they buy tickets for one day and that's the day he's not there. So, but while I was there, I did have a chance to spy Marina Sirtis at the show, and Dave Pascarella actually took the photo op with her, so maybe that might that picture may show up on Facebook. But she, I was struck by that she was significantly shorter than I anticipated.
Yeah, she's show, tiny.
She's kind of tiny, and on the show they at least film her to make her seem, you know, 5'5", 5'6", whatever. But I'm thinking she was probably about 5'1", 5'2". And maybe I'm wrong. You know, I don't know. I haven't checked her, you know, her online stats to see if they have her height. Maybe I'm wrong on it, but that's what she appeared to me. And then the other thing, I'm not a fan of body art. But for whatever reason, I always seem to notice it on people. And I was just a little surprised to see on her, I believe, right shoulder that she's got a little little ink. I couldn't tell what it was.
She's a bit of a rock chick, though, isn't she?
I guess.
I really
don't know very much of her personality.
Yeah, she's a bit of a rock chick, and she's a funny cockney in real life. Because whenever Deep Space Nine was on her, I was like, not Deep Space Nine, Next Generation, I was like, I wish they'd let her be more her. She's actually genuinely funny, and she doesn't give a shit about what she says either, which is funny.
What I saw of her when she was interacting with people, she seemed very outgoing and welcoming to the people who came over and you know, took the photo op or just stopped by to say hello or whatever. I did not have an opportunity to say anything to her, but she did appear to be genuine, like a warm person that you would, you know, you would enjoy the experience of having met her.
Yeah, she seems very much to be one of those people for whom her character does her a disservice or shows her to be actually a better actor than you give her credit for.
That's sad, because it seems like in general, the characters from The Next Generation that kind of get dumped on are Will Wheaton's Wesley Crusher and Marina Sirtis's Deanna Troi. And that's kind of disappointing that, you know, Marina Sirtis might be a more outgoing and fun-loving character, but she's kind of, you know, sidelined by the fact that she has to play this very stoic, ridiculous character who obviously always quotes the obvious.
Yes, I'm sensing aggression, Captain.
Yeah, they're
maybe that's because they've locked phasers on us.
Yeah.
But I think I see that as a byproduct of the scripting and failure to view either of those actors as being significant to the show and you know, leaving them behind. And it's kind of surprising too, particularly with Wesley, because I think they talked about him as being, you know, kind of a breakout star, you know, somebody for the younger audience to relate to and everything, and then they never really wrote him very well.
No, they wrote him as the smug kid who knew everything, and he was not relatable. He was more, you know, when you're super smart and super intelligent and can solve everything, which seemed to be his purpose for like the first season at least, it just became annoying. It's like, oh, how's Wesley going to get us out of this time? And for me, watching the show, the character annoyed the heck out of me.
And I think they learned a lesson, because Jake on this show is a far more relatable character.
Well, he's an actual kid. He's not super smart. I mean, he's smart. He's obviously educated. We'll see in the show that he's working on creating a transceiver, a transponder. He's not a stupid character, but he's not ultra intelligent and can figure out, you know, how to manufacture a different warp field so the ship can go faster. You know, he's just a kid, and I think that he plays that well, and Wheaton wasn't allowed to play that for whatever reason the writers wanted to put him in that role.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's you know, and he seems to, in adulthood, have embraced the geek culture and everything, and it's kind of a shame that that he isn't more embraced for that reason. Anyway, Whispers, huh?
Yes, there's an episode. We should talk about it.
O'Brien awakens to a station full of strangers.
Not one of them was real.
Where nothing seems normal.
All I could think of was that this was not my Keiko.
And friends.
They got to you.
Act like enemies.
All right, let's have a little talk.
Who the hell are you?
Has a mysterious force taken over the crew?
Just surrender to them and you'll be fine.
Or is O'Brien losing his mind?
Turn the ship around and go back.
On the next episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Whispers is the 34th episode of Deep Space Nine, and it first aired, it's season 2 episode 14, aired on February 6th, 1994, directed by Les Landau, written by Paul Robert Coyle, and let's see, do we have any guest stars on this? We have Todd Waring as Ensign DeCurtis, Susan Bay as Admiral Rollman, Philip Lestrange as Kotu, and Hannah Haiti as Molly. Traveling by himself, Miles O'Brien takes a runabout through the wormhole. He narrates a personal log in which he says that they do not want him to warn the Paradas, although he admits that he does not know who they are. He recalls the events leading up to this point, and as he describes them, he enters a flashback. Please put the flashback music here, Sean. Miles had just returned from a meeting with a species known as the Paradas, in which they discussed security measures for upcoming peace talks. He awoke to find Keiko and Molly dressed and eating breakfast. At 5:30 a.m., Keiko seemed somewhat suspicious, and Molly did not want Miles to give her a kiss. But he thought little of it as Keiko left the quarters with Molly. Upon reporting for duty, O'Brien discovered an officer had begun working on the security arrangements without him, apparently under orders from Sisko. He decided to pay Sisko a visit, but thought better of it when he saw Sisko and Keiko having a private discussion on the promenade. Later, Sisko told O'Brien to report for an annual physical, and when asked about his discussion with Keiko, claimed it was about Jake Sisko's grades. After an overly thorough examination by Bashir, O'Brien believed people's strange behavior that morning must have been because he had contracted some sort of disease. However, the doctor gave him a clean bill of health. Jake asked O'Brien for help with a science project, but when O'Brien mentioned his grades, Jake said they were fine. Additionally, problems he had been assigned to fix seemed to have been intentionally designed to make him spend additional time repairing them. Even Kira acted somewhat suspicious towards him. He reviewed the other officers' logs, which confirmed that Sisko and the others were observing his movements, although to what end, it was unclear. When Odo returned from a meeting with the Paradas, he offered to investigate the situation, an island of friendship in a sea of suspicion. In his log, O'Brien alludes to having made other preparations while he awaited a response from Odo. As he pondered the matter at Quark's, the Ferengi approached him from behind and declared, "The odds are against you, O'Brien." Although Quark was only referring to O'Brien's scheduled racquetball game with Bashir, the chief asked to change the subject. Quark brought the Paradas up, intent on finding out about the potential customers. O'Brien told Quark to look elsewhere for such information and began to leave, as Odo asked him to come with him to the security office. After a brief discussion, a strange look from Odo gave O'Brien reason to suspect the conspiracy had widened. He was about to leave Odo's office when Sisko and Kira entered with phasers, followed by Dr. Bashir with a sedative. "Who the hell are you?" O'Brien exclaimed, to which Kira calmly responded, "We don't want to hurt you." O'Brien used one of his improvisations to stun the crew members and took out two security officers before fleeing to the promenade. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm getting messages that are beeping and they throw me off. I apologize. O'Brien attempted emergency transport.
You're far too popular.
Sounds like Facebook.
Yeah, you know what it is. Okay,
Close down Facebook.
Beeping. I'm going to just close Facebook. There. Stop beeping at me, you people. Now, where was I? Can you edit this to make it sound like I have any intelligence at all?
Of course I can.
I'm so sure.
Andy would know. I edit out all his errors, but he'd never listen.
See, I just like to assume Andy sounds smart to begin with. That's my
shut up, Steven.
All right, let me pick this up where I left off. O'Brien attempted an emergency transport to the runabout Rio Grande, but the computer responded, unable to complete request. Please contact the station commander for assistance. He discarded his comm badge in a corridor to make it harder for the crew to track him and set up a series of force fields. Using maintenance conduits and his intimate knowledge of the station, he made his way to the runabout and escaped. He contacted Admiral Rollman of Starbase 401 to warn her that the command crew of Deep Space Nine was under some form of alien influence, but she ordered him to return to the station and assured him he would not be harmed. That was when O'Brien set a course for the wormhole. Now, en route to the Paradis system in the Gamma Quadrant, O'Brien is being pursued by the Mekong. Unable to reach the system before the Mekong overtakes him, he travels towards one of Parada 4's moons and manages to outmaneuver the other runabout, which assumes another course. He follows the Mekong to Parada 2 and beams to the surface, where he finds Sisko and Kira with a pair of Paradin rebels. One of the Paradins shoots him, and when the door opens, Bashir is behind it along with O'Brien. It is revealed that the Paradin government abducted O'Brien and created a replicant designed to assassinate the rebels' delegation at the peace talks. The clone was so closely modeled on the real O'Brien, he was completely unaware that he was a clone. Presumably, the Paradins intended to activate him at a certain point in time. Before he dies, the O'Brien clone says Keiko's name and grabs the real O'Brien's shoulder. "What about her?" the real O'Brien asks. "Tell her I love," the clone whispers as he dies. Roll credits.
See, which I didn't watch.
I would have loved, you know, if his final line when he said "I love," I would have loved it was something like pudding or something like that.
Coffee in the afternoon.
Yeah, I love Hostess fruit pies.
Or if he just broke into song, what is it like?
I love pina coladas and walks in the rain.
Just gets up and it turns into like a big dance number with the entire cast.
And then we cut to and he's just died and all that was in his head.
That was his final. That was his life passing behind his before his eyes.
That was his vision. That was the thing that he sees as he dies. Yeah.
Either that, or you know, he could have done the Roy Batty, you know, speech from Blade Runner, since he is a replicant.
He is indeed. Yeah.
There you go.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Keiko from behind.
Ooh. Wow. Go ahead, Paul. What did you think about this one?
I kind of like this one. It was slow moving again. Pacing might have been an issue, but I liked the concept. I felt a little Manchurian Candidate. I felt a little Blade Runner. I felt a little
body bit, snatches.
Yeah, a little bit of body snatches, and I felt a little bit better done than the was it the season one closeout on TNG with Conspiracy.
Yeah. Mm.
I felt like a similar vibe to that at certain points, but I thought better done than that. So overall, I would have to give this a thumbs up from my perspective. Not a greatly paced episode, a little slow moving again, but a real good sense of paranoia that develops as the episode's going on that I really felt kind of just started to hit when he's sitting and having breakfast with his wife and daughter, and then it just kind of like ramps up as it's going on. And then kind of the twist at the end when you find out that he's the replicant. So overall, like I said, I'm giving it a thumbs up.
Yeah. The unfortunate thing is when I first watched this, I took away from it, you know, the whole paranoid thing. But unfortunately, the ending just didn't sit with me. And you know, when I initially watched it, I had completely, by the end of it, when I did my rewatch, I had completely forgot what the ending was. And it's not that it's an unenjoyable episode. It just wasn't, for me, all that memorable. You know, this seems to be one of those episodes that we'll get later on throughout the series. And I think Gene Hendricks mentioned that they have these episodes which are torture O'Brien episodes, where O'Brien gets something bad happened to him and everyone's dumping on him or stuff. And it's an interesting concept that this isn't really O'Brien at the end, and that's a nice sort of twist episode. But there were just, it didn't seem as memorable as other episodes for me. So that would be my only negative thing to say about this.
I liked how this one was shot. I loved that for the entire episode, we're led to believe that O'Brien is normal and weird shit's happening around him. And then we get the ending where we realize actually O'Brien was the weird one. And it throws everything that was happening into a very different light when you get to the end of the episode. Like the reason that Keiko got Molly the hell out of Dodge was because she was having to deal with someone that wasn't her husband. And the reason that Sisko's lying to him, and there's a reason that Jake suddenly can't come over. And all of these elements to the story take a different feel once you get to the conclusion. And I liked all of that. I think the director did a really good job with it, keeping it all focused on O'Brien. Because like they say in the Deep Space Nine Companion, they didn't have the luxury here of cutting to subplots. The minute you do that, the ending's ruined.
I was going to say, I think what's interesting about this is later on in the series, we're going to see the introduction of the Dominion as essentially the shapeshifters. And that's going to sort of play in, you know, this kind of feeling of paranoia is going to play into later episodes where you're going to be wondering, you know, could this actually be a thing? Could all of these people have been taken over by the shapeshifters and they're just replicating who they are? So this, I like the idea of the paranoia and then approaching on that, but I don't think it was executed as well as it possibly could have been, at least for me then.
I think it scored as well in the dialogue. Some of the dialogue in this one's hysterical. It's hurt by Deep Space Nine still not being serialized enough. So you've got O'Brien, who was injured in the last episode and told to take a week off, suddenly returning back to the station from somewhere else this week. And there's a kind of an implication they may have been able to tie those two elements together better. But you know how Deep Space Nine was at this point. They just went with the next script that was ready.
Yeah.
I love some of the dialogue. Your sense of humor seems normal. I don't have a sense of humor. How's your sex life? I don't have a sense of humor. That was funny. And to me, there's a clue very early on in the episode that all is not right. When he asks Quark, he's talking to Quark about something and he says, there's a rule of acquisition. I don't remember the number. And you're like, that's bullshit. Quark knows every one of those rules of acquisitions backwards. And I got, was that a clue? That something was awry, that Quark didn't know a rule of acquisition. It may not have been. It may have just been me clinging on to something.
No, but I caught that too. I think that was intentional, that they threw that out there as a red herring.
I really enjoyed watching this one. I think it's one of those, it's like a Twilight Zone-y type thing that once you know the ending, it probably doesn't hold up to multiple viewings. But given the fact that I had no memory of this episode at all, going into watching it, the ending was still quite, oh yeah, it wasn't him. Brilliant.
Yeah, I think, as you know, as our recording, for what it's worth, we record two episodes at a time, for anybody who's unaware of that, if the listener doesn't know. So we did Armageddon Game, and then we followed it with this one, and I do think it would have benefited from not having two episodes in a row where O'Brien is being used as a pawn of an alien race.
Yeah, if they could have pushed this one back a couple of episodes, that probably would have helped.
Mm-hmm. They do have a bit of continuity in the series, because in the last episode, in Armageddon Game, they had the, was it the Ganges or the Rio Grande, or one of the runabouts got blown up by the aliens in that, and they mention in this episode that he had to take the a different runabout to escape from the station. So there was a bit of continuity that he couldn't use the same runabout that was destroyed the last episode. But other than that, yeah, it would have probably been a little better if we had two episodes dealing specifically with O'Brien being hunted down or having dealings with an alien race spaced out further between the series or between this season.
Yeah, the other thing that struck me watching these two back-to-back, because peek behind the curtain, we knew we were doing this, but it's been such a long time, we kind of solidified it 2 days before we record. It's why I watched them both in quick succession. The incidental music on Deep Space Nine's boring as hell, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
God, it's dull. I don't know why that stuck out to me watching these two back to back. I just thought the scores are bland.
See, you know, I actually like, you know, despite the fact that eventually you'll get this sort of guitar riff, I enjoy the theme music for Deep Space Nine. But yeah, I will admit sometimes the incidental music, and I don't know whether it's Dennis McCarthy doing all the incidental music or whether someone else is coming and doing it. But yeah, sometimes it just doesn't really do it for me.
And I think sometimes having a little better music helps with the pacing issues that I saw in this one. You know, it makes the scene more compelling, and it makes it just kind of move along, whereas bland background music has exactly the opposite effect.
Yeah, I don't know why it struck out to me, but there's no hummable themes from Deep Space Nine, is there? There's no Spock music, that little twangy now, 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 now. There's no fight music. There's no Baylock music. There's no Mirror Universe music. It's just all very boring, wallpapery, tedious background stuff. And yeah, a little bit of excitement in the music may have helped some of the action scenes.
Now I'm wondering if, you know, once we get to, you know, the sixth season where they do the trials and tribulations, if they up the music to try and integrate the Deep Space Nine sort of themes along with the original series themes. But yeah, I will agree with you, there's nothing really aside from the opening theme, there's no real recognizable soundtrack cues or music cues for Deep Space Nine that could tell you this is the show that it's coming from.
Yeah. Like I said, I don't know why that struck me watching these two, because it's not like I've been particularly enamored of the incidental music of Deep Space Nine ever. But just watching them back to back, there was a bland wallpaper feel to the incidental score that just stuck out at me this time.
Maybe that's why I kind of viewed it as sort of unmemorable, you know, and just, you know, why the ending sort of slipped my mind between the first viewing and the second viewing. So, I did like, you know, everyone turned in decent performances. Everyone trying to be sort of obfuscating of the knowledge that this person in O'Brien was not the actual O'Brien were all right, but I think the one who pulled it off best, at least for me, was Rene Auberjonois, however you pronounce the name, Odo. You know, when Odo came back onto the station from whatever the Paradin system and got with O'Brien, I thought he was the most relatable to this one. And I don't know if initially Odo knew that this was a replicant O'Brien or whether he was just faking it so well, even better than I think like Keiko and Sisko were. I don't know. Do you think that Odo knew about this prior to getting back to the station, or whether he found out after he started his investigation?
I was under the impression that he did know. And that he was just placating the faux O'Brien.
Well, see, if that's the case, then I think he pulled off the trying not to let in on the fact that he knew that O'Brien wasn't the actual O'Brien, because you could kind of tell through like the way they were acting, you know, everyone sort of checking up on O'Brien, that there was something going on with all these people. Odo felt like he was the most sympathetic and most concerned about, you know, O'Brien's misgivings with what might be going on with the crew in the station.
I think he knew prior. I think that makes sense that Odo would have figured it out in some way.
All right, then.
See, there's not really a lot else to talk about in this one, because as we pointed out, there are no subplots, because by the nature of the plot of the show, there can't be, because we would have cut away to the other characters talking about what they're doing with O'Brien, and that would have undercut the ending. So the Deep Space Nine companion does say that because of that, this episode actually ran short, and they had to come up with a couple of additional scenes to make it the requisite length.
And that may be the source of the pacing problems.
Hmm.
when you have a script that you're satisfied with and then you have to just pad it out, you know, that is going to make for a... more often than not, that's going to make for some pacing issues.
Cole Meany's brilliant in this one. In fact, I think the entire cast's brilliant in this one.
I thought the acting was all very well done. And again, I bought into the paranoia. So I think that's the key to it. If you buy into the paranoia, I think it brings the episode up a notch.
I did like that before we started recording, Sean said the synopsis for this one should be O'Brien is paranoid, the end. And I wish you'd gone with that. That would have been funny.
That's essentially what it is. O'Brien's paranoid about everyone on the station, and you know, we find out at the end that, you know, he's the one who's everyone was paranoid about. So, yeah, you know, and it's, I agree. You know, you guys sort of talked me up. I might give a little higher rating than I was actually thinking about doing, but yeah, it's not a bad episode, but it's just by the entire nature of it, it's just kind of just there.
I'm back to just the point I just made, that if you're not buying into the paranoia, if you're not watching this and being pulled into the episode, then I think it's boring. So it really is totally dependent, I think, on your ability to jump into the episode. If you know, and obviously everybody's mileage is going to vary on that. So, you know, I can definitely see where somebody might not like this episode. I did. That's ultimately what it comes down to.
I liked it as well.
Okay, well, do we want to go ahead and go to ratings?
Sure, and it's my episode, so I'll dive into it. And as I said in the beginning, I kind of liked the sense of different things that I felt when I was watching it. The Manchurian Candidate kind of came from the end of it, and then the conspiracy vibe I kind of had through the whole thing. I bought into the paranoia, and I also bought into the premise that everyone else was wrong and O'Brien was, you know, the man alone, and the plot twist that it turned out that he was the one who was wrong and everybody else was kind of trying to take care of business. I liked that twist. It did have a Twilight Zone feel to me, especially when it turned out that he was in love with Keiko. So overall, I'm giving it a thumbs up, as I said, and I'm giving it 3 stars. Solid episode.
I'm going to fall in line with Paul and give 3 stars. Again, there's nothing wrong with it. I think it probably does work better on initial viewing because you don't know the twist. I love the acting and I loved how it was shot. And yeah, it's a little bit slow in places. Again, probably because of the rewrite stuff, but a solid 3 from me as well.
I'm just going to go down like a half step and give it a 2.5. You know,
You're an honorary booger, by and large, aren't you?
I guess. Well, you can't...
He just likes to be 0.5 off from us all the time. Doesn't matter whether it's above or below.
Yeah, that's essentially it. You know, we have to have some sort of disagreement. Otherwise, you know, this would be a boring show. You know, I don't disagree with anything you guys have said. You know, it's just when I watched this the first time, I was like, it's interesting. Paranoid episode. You know, you have the sort of invasion of the body snatchers from the aspect of the person who's been body snatched. But the fact that by the end of the first watch through, when I tried to remember how it ended, I couldn't, sort of gave me a bad feeling about it. So I was actually going to give it a 2, but you know, getting to talk with you guys and discuss the show, you know, I bumped it up another 0.5, so 2.5 for me. Now, once again, I'm pretty certain Warren wasn't in this episode, even though we did have a couple of shots panning over the bar. There was, however, a pack lid in the show.
There was, yeah.
And I don't know why they're letting pack lids on the station, because they're just going to screw things up.
They go fast.
We wish they would go away fast.
It's surprising they have callbacks to that episode, because it was not a good episode.
No, it was a bag of shit.
No, and the pack lids are just, you know, people say that, you know, the Next Generation really destroyed the Ferengi character. The Ferengi characters, I guess, got redeemed in Deep Space Nine. Do you think they're putting the pack lids in there in hopes that they can redeem the pack lids?
I think the pack lids are irredeemable.
Well, I would have to agree with you there.
The irredeemable pack lids. The Deep Space Nine.
Oh, I hope Shag is listening to this, so...
Don't be daft! He only listens to himself. He's a raving egomaniac.
Hey. Okay, well, do we want to go ahead and read an email? Do you want to do this, Andy, or have you got it open?
I've not got my phone with me, which is where I normally access the email. Hold on a minute. Google Mail, unless you want to do it because it'll take me a while to get in.
I can go ahead and read it if you
go want. On, you do it then. Says right. Log in.
It's a this short one. He'll have it read by the time you would have found it.
Yeah. This is another email from our good friend Gene Hendricks. It's entitled The Circle, a Solid Episode. Gene writes in, Paul, Sean, and Andy, so Andy gets the and credit again, lucky man. I agree with all of you, which is the right thing to say, that Louise Fletcher is brilliant in her role. The talking down to everyone with a knowing grin on her face is wonderful. It makes me hate the character so much, see previous email, that you can't help realize how great an actress she was. She and Frank Langella's character are definitely heroes of their own story, doing what they feel is right for Bajor, no matter how wrong it really is. As to the orb of infinite porn, oh my, is it possible for anyone to see just one of these and say, you know what, I'm not going to risk it, and walk away? Yeah, it's a Chekhov's gun kind of situation, but every time these things are used, there are problems. I think I wrote just the shortest Deep Space Nine episode. They find an orb and they leave it alone. The end. You know, maybe if you get the Tales from the Seventh Fleet guys together, you can do something like that. That'd be good. You know, just a little, you know, 3-minute episode. Regardless, he finishes up saying, I'd put this as an average episode, but it's at the connecting point. And as Paul said, so it's a little less of a standalone than I'd like, but enjoyable nonetheless, Gene. And of course, Gene hosts the Hammer Strikes podcast, the Quantum Cast, Anime Freaks, Comic Book Fight Club, and he has to do something else. Oh, Legends of the Superheroes. That's been fun.
Gene, take a break. Take a breath, man.
I know. He is Gene, the podcasting machine.
He's got far too much time on his hands.
And he writes into so many shows. I know he does, you know, the other show I do with Michael Bradley, the Parallel Line show, he's writing into that show as well. He is an email hack. And we love
in
him
in a good way.
It. And we love him.
He is an avid podcast listener. In addition to podcaster.
Yeah, I remember before he actually started up some of the shows over on Tutor Freaks, he said that he went and listened to the entirety of the libraries of all the Tutor Freaks shows. And I'm like, good Lord, man, that is some dedication.
Is he still sane after that, or is he now a gibbering wreck?
And you'd have to ask Paul about that. He's the one who probably has a bit more experience meeting with him.
I'm gonna reserve judgment on that. I agree with what Gene said, but I think I could take it a step further on one point where he says about how Louise Fletcher and Langella's characters are the hero of their own story. Yes, but I also think there's a lot of just justification going on where they do what's best for them and what's best for their power-craving ways, and then justify it by trying to say that it's best for Bajor. But ultimately, they are very self-motivated people that are really seeking their power. In particular, Louise Fletcher, and I think we see much, much later in the series how her goals and her actions change so as to suit her being the most powerful person that she can be in the scene. Or in the situation that she puts herself into. So it almost makes them even more complicated than just thinking they're the hero.
I get by that. Do you think that essentially if Frank Langella's character would have continued on through the show, that he would have aligned himself with someone else, if he would have thought that that would have given him a better chance to progress in his power or progress in his status?
I have no doubt in my mind that he would have. And the same with her. She'll align herself with the person who's going to ultimately put her in power. And some of that is because, that, you know, they like many raving egomaniacs, think it is the best for the country or for the country of the world, whatever, for me to be in charge because I'm the smartest, best person to do everything. So by whatever means I get there, that will be what's best for the world.
Thank goodness we don't have any politicians anywhere on this planet like that at all.
It is a good thing. It is a good thing that every politician, certainly in the United States, is out for the betterment of the world.
Completely and wholly altruistic, wanting to make sure that the citizenry get the best. That's the political way here in the States.
I'm very fortunate that I live in a country like yours where that is also true. Is this the point where we all just look at the camera?
Yes, right now we're all looking at the camera and going, do you believe us?
No.
Well, I think after you say that, you should have do 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 do.
Gene, thank you for writing in. We know you're going to write in on this episode. We really appreciate you writing in. It's great getting emails from our listener, Gene. I'm certain there's got to be more listeners than just Gene, but thank you again for writing in. If you'd like to write into the show, of course, the email address is listentotheprophets@gmail.com. I don't think we mentioned that last time, but you know, it's in the, if you go to the Tutor Freaks website, it's in the posting up there, so you can contact us there. Are we good with this? Are we out? Are we ready to go to a next time?
Yeah, I got nothing else.
All right.
I think we're good.
Okay, take us away, Andy.
Next time on an all-new episode of Listen to the Prophets, it's going to be a paradise, hopefully.
Hopefully there will be some dashboard light to have that
light.
There you go, another one. Zing, I am the musical master.
Oh, goodbye, everybody.
See you later.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com. Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.